Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hi there, welcome to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond. Now, sometimes medical research is a bit like detective work, and we've got plenty of that for you today. With the mystery disease in Germany, which might have been spread by tiny shrews, to the current attempts in China to work out why people in one city are being affected by a serious respiratory illness. And the app In My Shoes that gives people the chance to know what everyday life is really like for patients with inflammatory bowel conditions.
You're in pain all the time, you're going to the loo 20, 30 times a day. And people say, you know, yeah, well, I had that before. It's like, yes, but not for 6 years.
And my guest today is the health editor of The Guardian newspaper, Sarah Bosley. And I wanted to start today, Sarah, by asking you about this respiratory illness that's been affecting people in China and is causing concern. How many people are affected and what sorts of symptoms do they have?
Well, so far there have been 59 cases and seven of those are said to be critical. So it's pretty nasty. The symptoms are generally fever, difficulty breathing, body aches, those sorts of things.
Now, of course, it rings alarm bells because it might remind people of the outbreak of SARS in Hong Kong and mainland China in 2003. But that's been ruled out, hasn't it, along with a lot of other things?
Yes. It's being generally called viral pneumonia, and that's an infection of the lungs that's caused by a virus, such as, for instance, flu or a cold, nasty cold. But, of course, SARS and MERS were also caused by viruses, coronaviruses in those cases. So you can really understand why they might worry about that. So SARS, for instance, is severe acute respiratory infection. These are respiratory diseases, so they've got a lot in common. They really will want to rule them out because those have been deadly. I mean, MERS, which is in dromedary camels, that's the main source of infection to man. That kills 35% of those people who get it. And there was a big death toll from SARS as well back in 2002-03. About 750 people died.
And so what's the next step to identify what it is? And then I guess to work out how people are catching it, where they're getting it from.
Yes, it's really important to find out the source. So it was only in 2017, just a couple of years ago, that they discovered that the source of SARS, for instance, was actually bats living in a cave in Yunnan province in China. And if they can do that, then they can start working out how perhaps to develop a vaccine for it. So the other thing to do is to look at where it's coming from. And the biggest clue to that, perhaps, is that some of them have actually been working in the seafood market. So it's just possible that they're picking up this infection in that way. And most novel viruses do actually come out of the animal kingdom.
So what's being done to protect people at the moment?
Well, people are being put into quarantine if they have come into contact with somebody who has this strange illness. And certainly in Singapore and Hong Kong, they're actually screening people who are coming from Wuhan and that area. And of course, it's going to be really important to track people and persuade them not to go and mix with everybody else, particularly because it's the Chinese New Year at the end of January and millions of people travel around the country going home. So it could be really, really problematic at that point.
And, yeah, because then it would be very hard to track the contacts people had if somebody then became ill, wouldn't it?
Yes, exactly. The same happens with any virus, including Ebola. You need to track those people who've been in contact with someone who's got the illness.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Now, there's another mystery which some medical detective work might have solved: the unexplained deaths of 8 people in Germany over the last 20 years from inflammation of the brain, known as encephalitis. Now, nobody knew why the brains of these patients became so inflamed. But now researchers from the Friedrich Luftfahrt Institute, which is on an island in the Baltic Sea, think they have the answer. The patients seem to have been infected with Bornavirus, which has long been known to affect horses, sheep and squirrels in a particular region of Germany. But when it comes to passing it on to humans, the culprit might be something much smaller: a bicoloured white-toothed shrew. Professor Martin Beer is the head of diagnostic virology at the Institute and told me how encephalitis affects people.
Encephalitis is a severe disease in mammals, especially also humans, and it's an inflammation of the brain where you have heavy headache and it can finalize with coma or death. So it's a dangerous disease.
And how long have you seen this in the area of Germany that you're looking at?
So there it's known for more than 100 years, but it was never connected to severe disease in humans. The disease was long known in livestock animals like horses or sheep, for example. And this is really new now, that humans can also be infected and get severe form of encephalitis, and most of the infected people die.
This has been something of a mystery till now, though, hasn't it?
What we learned with the new paper now is that the main part of the infections is directly received from shrews, so a special kind of bee-colored shrew, which is especially infected in Germany or Austria, and from there the virus can jump to other mammals, including humans.
And so in a way you've been doing detective work to try to work out what the cause is. How certain can you be that people are somehow getting infected from shrews?
So what we did is we diagnosed by molecular techniques these viruses, and what we also do is we analyze the complete genome of these viruses. And there is known genomes from infected horses and from infected shrews. And what we could show is that the sequences from the viruses in the humans are very, very similar to the ones we can find in shrews or horses in the same area.
And sadly, these people that you have studied had all died. How did they contract the disease from shrews? Do we know?
So this is still a little bit a mystery. So we are very, very sure that this is by contact to shrews, direct or indirect. So the shrews are shedding the virus, for example, by their urine. On the other hand, if you have a cat likes to catch shrews, and they kill the shrews and they bring them to the cat owner. So we don't know exactly how this really works, or if you even then have to have a kind of a scratch where the contact happens. So this is part of the future research.
And do you know whether these particular individuals did have cats, say, or lived in very rural areas where these shrews might be?
So in the Lancet infectious disease paper, we looked at the family of the infected patients. Had they cats or not, or are they in a rural area? And it turns out that this is really rural areas, and most of the patients also had cats or contact to cats. But it's still a hypothesis.
So you don't know yet what people could do living in these areas to avoid becoming infected?
I think the good message is that it's really rare cases. So nobody has to be really scared about that. But the mortality rate is very high. Therefore, what we say is avoid direct contact to shrews in the areas where they can be infected. So if your cat brings a shrew, or if there is a dead shrew, don't touch it by your plain hand. And this is a major part of the ongoing research to find out how the infection is really spilled over from the infected shrews to the humans.
And these white-toothed shrews, are they quite common in this particular area?
So they are a protected species. There is not a lot of research on this animal species. So nobody really knows how many of these bee-colored shrews are around. It's a species which is seen not only in the Borna virus endemic region, it's also in France or north of Italy or in the eastern part of Europe, but there Borna disease virus is not seen.
And if somebody has become infected, now that you know more about the Borna virus, would it be possible to spot it early and treat it somehow?
So on one hand, it's easy to diagnose in a late stage, if you have a brain biopsy, or if the person is dead, you have brain material. But if you have a severe encephalitis, then you develop antibodies. And these antibodies can be measured in the serum or the cerebrospinal fluid. So I think, therefore, in the future, we will have also cases which are diagnosed much earlier. And then we have to talk about any possibilities of treatment. At the moment, we have not really good options.
So what are you going to look at next in your research?
Severe encephalitis is not always tested for Borna virus in the endemic regions, so like Bavaria, Austria. So there we need more testing. And with more cases, I think we will have also more clear answers to questions like, is there contact to shrews? What kind of contacts are possible?
Martin Beer. Sarah, it's interesting, isn't it, that it's a vet who's working out what's made the humans ill rather than a doctor?
Yes, well, they're obviously important players with all these diseases that are coming out of the animal population and into humans.
Now, imagine that you suddenly realise you need to go to the toilet but only have a couple of minutes to get there. At home, that might be OK, but what if you're driving or out on a country walk or you're visiting a new city where you don't even know where the toilets are? For people with inflammatory bowel conditions, this could be your everyday life. But to imagine what the discomfort, embarrassment and inconvenience are really like if you haven't experienced them can be hard. So to give relatives or medical staff a better idea, there's a new app called In My Shoes. And Health Check reporter Madeline Finlay's been to find out what kind of difference it might make.
It's not just a bad stomach. There is a lot more to it. It's everything. You're in pain all the time. You're going to the loo 20, 30 times a day. And people say, you know, yeah, well, I had that before. It's like, yes, but not for 6 years. It's in the best intentions, obviously.
That's Michelle, who suffers from a long-term condition called Crohn's disease. Crohn's is a type of inflammatory bowel disease, alongside another condition known as ulcerative colitis. And, as Michelle points out, it can be really difficult to live with. Fraser Cummings, consultant gastroenterologist and clinical lead for the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Service at Southampton General Hospital, explains.
Inflammatory bowel disease is made up of two main conditions, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Both conditions cause inflammation in the bowel. Ulcerative colitis exclusively affects the large bowel, the colon, whereas Crohn's disease can affect any part of the bowel, literally from the lips to the tail end. Symptoms include tummy pain, diarrhea, bleeding when you go to the toilet, fatigue. We think that it affects about 1 in 300 of the population. To put that in a different way, everybody will know someone with one of these conditions, but they may not be aware that the individual actually is suffering from it.
To help people understand more about inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, charity Crohn's and Colitis UK have developed an immersive app called In My Shoes, which simulates what life with the condition is like. Fraser and the IBD group at Southampton General Hospital were the first clinical team to try it out.
My name's Anne Sanderson and I'm a clinical nurse specialist in inflammatory bowel disease. The In My Shoes app I found extremely informative. I've been doing this job now for many, many years and I think I maybe was a bit cynical that I'd have something new to learn from using it. But I was wrong. Every time the notification pinged and I had to find a toilet within 3 minutes, it made me think about what happens if I was out walking the dog. What happens if I was in the supermarket? What happens if the toilet I found was out of use or didn't have toilet paper?
I'm going to give the app a go. OK, I've found it. It does actually look a little bit like a gut. And it's asking me which IBD I am going to select for the day. So I'll go with Crohn's today. And now I've come to a screen where it's telling me that it's going to update me on my mood and energy and pain. And finally, on the last page, it's about diet. And today it's telling me that I need to avoid foods with high fibre, such as fruit and vegetables. So no to the apple in my bag. And so I'll just press go. Anne Sanderson says the In My Shoes app made her think carefully about how she interacts with patients.
The one surprise for me was I missed a call from my IBD nursing team, and we often try to call patients when they contact us, and it made me realise that actually I was busy doing something else and I just didn't look at my phone. So it has made me think about the time of day that we contact our patients.
This insight isn't just important for clinicians. Michelle was diagnosed with Crohn's disease 6 years ago and has been on several different medications, undergone innumerable colonoscopies, had 3 operations, including a bowel reconstruction, yet she said her boyfriend and particularly her mum were still surprised after using the app.
She actually said, you know, she's been in tears. She couldn't actually believe how difficult it had been. And for that to come from someone who was there with me every single day, she helped me, you know, go to the loo and not get there in time and sort the stoma bag out. And for her to say that she didn't know the depth of it, because it, you know, it tells you that you need to wake up and go to the loo and you didn't get there in time. And how does that make you feel?
Ah, here's my first notification of the day. And it's telling me I need to find a toilet in 3 minutes. That's not long if I'm in the middle of something at work, or even if I was just on my way into work. Anne Sanderson hopes that giving others some personal insight into the condition might help some of her current or future patients feel more comfortable about speaking out.
It's very common for patients to be extremely embarrassed about talking about their bowels. We have to explain to them in a very supportive way that this is our job. We talk about it every single day, and it's getting them to feel comfortable with us as a team that they can be open about and honest about how many times they're going, because it's key in how we treat them.
Raising awareness for conditions like Crohn's is particularly important, as although most patients go through phases where they have no symptoms at all, during flare-ups it still remains a largely invisible disease.
Often patients will superficially look well. I think it's, everyone should have a go at this just to really try and understand actually what it's like to live with these conditions.
I have spoken to pretty much everybody I know about my poo. It is something you just have to get over. Like, absolutely nobody enjoys talking about it, even though every single person does it. It's just kind of dependent on how well you do it. So if you don't do it very well, you need to talk about it more. You do it well, you don't talk about it at all. That's why with this app, it really has brought it into the light, and there is definitely a kind of, oh, so I found this app and I did it and I never realised what you went through, and then people can start talking about it more. It's definitely better.
Madeline Finlay reporting, and I love the apps that people think of these days. You're listening to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond, and my guest today is The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley. Now, Sarah, anti-inflammatory drugs are usually used for things like pain relief, but there's a new paper out bringing together and reanalysing all the studies that have been done on using it to treat major depression. What have they found?
Well, they found that these anti-inflammatory drugs actually work reasonably well in major depression. These are all sorts of drugs. They are the NSAIDs, non-steroidal, that is, anti-inflammatory drugs, such as ibuprofen, for instance, omega-3, statins, antibiotics, corticosteroids, a whole range of drugs that have been tried out because people have had this, if you like, hypothesis in the past that it's possible that they may have an effect. And it seems from the trials that the drugs work better than placebo, which is means, you know, those people who had a drug have got better than those people who just had a sugar pill of some sort. And also they are a lot better, it seems, if the person actually is taking antidepressant treatment as well.
So they can be a sort of add-on to that. And were some of these drugs more effective than others? Because it's such a range of different things.
Yes, it really is a range, isn't it? I don't think they've got enough people involved to be able to tell the difference between the different drugs. So they've generally just lumped them all together. Although there are 30 trials involved here, that only actually numbers something like 1,600 people. So it's not huge.
But wouldn't there be side effects of some of these drugs?
Yes, there always is a risk of side effects with any pill at all. And people should definitely go and see their doctors and not just start taking statins or corticosteroids in order to relieve their depression. And ibuprofen, for instance, can actually cause stomach bleeds if it's taken for a period of time.
And so do you think that some doctors will start prescribing them for depression, or is it too early for that to happen and too early, I guess, for people to do this themselves?
Well, the researchers actually who've pulled all this information together are saying that more investigation's needed and they will have to do more trials, I think. But it's a very interesting finding. It's, doctors won't be prescribing them just yet.
Thank you, Sarah. Now, you tend to think of students as young and fairly robust when it comes to getting ill. But in countries such as the UK, there have been outbreaks of bacterial meningitis at colleges and universities, spread by close physical contact, including kissing. Now, there is a vaccination against it, which students are encouraged to have these days. But now a team of British researchers has recruited hundreds of students to test an additional layer of protection, nose drops laced with friendly bacteria. Professor Robert Reed is director of the NIHR Biomedical Research Centre at the University of Southampton, and he got into this line of research after an increase in cases and even deaths of teenagers and young adults in the UK back in the mid-1990s. And he told Dr. Mark Porter what's already known about the bacteria that can cause meningitis.
We can find this organism by taking a throat swab from a patient. But the really curious thing is that actually we can find this in normal people as well. And in fact, we now know that at any one time, about 20% of young people are carrying Neisseria meningitidis, the causative pathogen, despite the fact that they have no symptoms at all.
This is particularly important to me because at the time of the outbreak, I was a GP in Stroud, which is one of the hot spots. And it was very much felt that, you know, there's something about the environment where we live, that there was these bacteria lived in Stroud. And actually, we now know that you know, you're saying millions of us potentially carry them in the backs of our noses and throats.
Well, yes. Right now in the UK, probably about 6 million people are carrying Neisseria meningitidis. Stroud was a real hotspot during the 90s. And we now know it will occur in a locality, and then there'll be transmission between individuals. And often this is saliva exchange or living closely together. And that's why you saw that expansion in Stroud.
So why is it that some people seem to carry this bacteria without any ill effect, and yet it causes such awful disease in others?
Well, only one in 10,000 people who are carrying the organism will get disease. There's been a lot of research into this, and actually there are one or two genetic factors that are involved in this, but other than these clues, we don't really know what distinguishes one person who gets disease from another person who carries but doesn't get disease.
Tell me about the research you're doing here with the nose drops. Where did the idea come from?
So about 10 years ago, we were investigating an observation that actually emerged from Stroud, that when you see another related microorganism, Neisseria lactamica, a very harmless bacterium, you see relatively lower rates of meningococcal disease. And this is an observation that was repeated not just in Stroud, but also in the United States. Now, nobody could explain this. They felt that it was probably due to cross-reacting antibodies being generated in the bloodstream by the carriage of the harmless bacterium that prevented disease by the harmful pathogen.
It was somehow warning the immune system.
The feeling was that it was due to some sort of cross-reacting immune response, exactly as you say, warning the immune system that there are Neisseria around. But this organism is carried in babies, nursing babies generally. That's what's called Neisseria lactamica. Babies carry it very frequently. Those babies appear to be protected against meningococcal disease. So what we did, we took students and we asked the question, well, if we infect students with the harmless bacterium, can we see a reduced carriage of the pathogen Neisseria meningitidis, a sort of competition thing? And students are a good population to study because, especially during the first term, you know, there's a lot of saliva exchange, a lot of socializing. This is the group that gets this massive expansion of the harmful pathogen and also a group in whom we see disease. So we infected 300 people with Neisseria lactamica, all students, and we found that it had a significant impact on whether they acquired the pathogen Neisseria meningitidis over the first term of university life. Very interesting. Clearly, this organism provides some protection.
Is it oversimplistic to describe it as a sort of as a friendly type of bacterium that is possibly literally just elbowing out the unfriendly one?
That's exactly what it is, although elbowing out is probably a nice general term for it. The problem is I can't be specific about exactly what that means, because if we could, then we would be able to harness that to prevent disease.
In the research you've done so far, has there been any downside to inoculating people with this bacterium?
We've now infected about 400 adults and we haven't heard any serious adverse events. And clearly the potential uses on a practical level would be as a simple way of preventing meningococcal disease, particularly in an outbreak. At the moment, what we do when there's a big outbreak, for example, in Africa, is that you have to respond by moving vaccine into the territory and then vaccinating people. That's a process that takes weeks. So by the time an epidemic has really got its legs, you know, the vaccine can be a little bit late. This is a simple solution where we could potentially give people nose drops that might prevent an epidemic from getting out of control.
Professor Robert Reed. Now, Sarah, before we go, there's good news for people who run marathons. Now, I've always thought that although running's good for you, and I like running, running that far surely can't be that good for you, what with the risk of dehydration and injuries and even heart problems. But it seems I'm wrong. There's something very good about it. What is it? What can it do for us?
It's very good indeed. It can actually rejuvenate your arteries. They found that this is a study of people who took up running in order to run a marathon, so they're novice marathon runners. And they found that 6 months of training actually reduced their arterial stiffness by the equivalent of a 4-year reduction in their arterial age.
And this was really quite a drop in blood pressure, wasn't it? The equivalent of taking medication for it.
Yes, absolutely. And the other great thing about it is that the effect was better, was bigger in those people who were older and were slower at running the marathon, actually, and in poorer health to start with.
That's good if it's good if you're slower. But is it the months of training rather than the marathon itself that's so good for people?
Oh, yes. And they've calculated that these novice runners actually did something like 6 to 13 miles per week of running. So it isn't the 26 miles at the end. It's the regular exercise, the regular running that really has an effect.
So you're tempted? You're going to sign up for next year's marathon, this year's marathon?
Well, it sounds like a really healthy thing to do, but actually, I don't think I will. It's tough going. And anyway, the British Heart Foundation said that you don't actually have to do 26 miles. One of their associate medical director commented that even a brisk walk on your lunch break will steer you towards better heart and circulatory health. So I think I'll be doing that.
Oh, that sounds a bit easier. Thank you very much, Sarah Bosley from The Guardian, for joining us today. And thank you too to the producer, Paula McGrath. You can find me on Instagram and on Twitter at Claudia Hammond. And I will be back at the same time next week when we're delving into the world of oxytocin, sometimes known as the hormone of love. And here's a word about something new from the BBC World Service.
For teenagers like me, it's hard to imagine a world where the tech we take for granted didn't exist.
We didn't have email back then. You know, everything was mail, or we didn't have internet.
So in our new podcast, Worldwise Web, 12 of us from around the world will be spending time with the people who invented it.
We believed someday everybody would have a cell phone.
Finding out how they came up with their ideas.
I'm always saying yes to the weirdest of things just so I can find all those crazy things in life that are really fun.
And asking for advice.
You've got to figure out what drives you. What makes you really happy? Do that.
That's Worldwise Web from the BBC World Service.
You have conducted probably one of the greatest interviews I've ever had.
To hear more about it, search for Worldwise Web wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow, okay, we are in a new world.
And look out for the first episode on the 10th of January.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much.